Welcome to Trump Watch. I'm Paul DiRienzo, and my guest is Stephen Taylor, who is joining me from Erbil in Iraq. It's a city in northern Iraq, and he's going to tell me what he's doing there and how he wound up there. Stephen and I know each other from his work in news as a news reporter, and I assume your reporting is taking you to Erbil. Tell me how you got there.
That's right. Thanks for having me. I first came to Kurdistan in 2013 to work for a university here and do some freelance journalism work. And then last summer, I was invited to participate in a fellowship grant for the International Center for Journalists. And we were covering refugee and IDP lives and situations here in Iraq and in northern Kurdistan. So that took us to Duhok, which is about 2.5 hours north of here. And we met the Sinjar community, the Yazidi community from Sinjar, who were all victims of the 2014 attempted genocide on Sinjar Mountain that everybody's pretty well aware of now.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, maybe not. Tell us a little bit about the Yazidi people and what the massacre of Sinjar was about.
Sure. Interestingly enough, today actually marks the third anniversary for the attempted genocide. What happened was when Daesh first came in across the border from Syria, one of the first places they went was to Sinjar, which is in northwestern Iraq. And the Yazidi community, a very ancient community, has a very different practice, a very different faith that many have called, apostate, and they see them as, you know, not a true belief or a true religion in terms of Islam. So I think Daesh kind of targeted them as for, you know, total, you know, genocide. And after they went after them, they forced them to march up into the mountain for about a week. No water, no food. A lot of people died just in that experience alone. A lot of people killed in the city of Sinjar in their attempt to get up to the mountain. This is an ancient place they will go to direct. And then after that week up there, they were pushed into essentially a death march for about another week without food or water, marching across the northern sort of Tigris plain up towards Duhok, and a lot more people killed as well.
Is the experience of the Yazidi people what is motivating you? Because it's a difficult where you are right now. You said it's hot, it's difficult. Tell me a little bit about the living conditions you're in right now.
Sure. We're experiencing, 110 plus every day. Today was 115. It'll be 117 in a couple of days. We're all generator power over here. So, they have to be cooled. So the generators will go out frequently. And when that happens, we have rolling power outages. And when we do, of course, that means no AC, no fan. And I mean, can't even imagine what the people are dealing with who are living in, tent cities and these other areas with no energy.
I see. Tell us a little bit about, so Daesh is ISIS. What's happening there and as far as the U.S. involvement?
Sure. They've been largely pushed out. As you know, the liberation of Mosul happened last month. I was there a couple of days before that took place. That was, of course, very positive for the people in the area, but it's also resulted in a lot of revenge killings now. There have been reports of just indiscriminate killing of men, women, and children. Anyone left alive in the city of Mosul has been targeted. Even people who are openly willing to surrender have been killed on the spot. And
so that's basically the Iraqi government soldiers looking for revenge against people they think were part of ISIS in Mosul.
Right. That's right. So because Mosul is not traditionally a Kurdish area, it's handled by the Iraqi forces. And Peshmerga, which is the military for the Kurds, assists there, as do the Shia militias, but it's really under the purview of the Iraqi military.
How far away is Erbil from Mosul?
We're about, again, around an hour and a half, 2 hours.
I see. So you're in Kurdish territory.
That's right. This is the capital of Kurdistan for Iraq.
Right. So this is the capital. It's Kurdish territory. So the Kurdish people, the Kurdish forces, the Kurdish people, I would say, are they in charge there in Erbil?
Absolutely. In fact, on September 25th, they're actually going to be voting for independence. So that's a big thing that's coming up. And I think the Kurds are right now, they're experiencing a real updraft, I guess, in their own independence and autonomy for the region. Kirkuk, which is a major disputed area before that, in terms of between them and the Iraqi government, Now with their help in Mosul, they're able to have more say in, you know, their own independence and autonomy. So I think it's a big time for them here.
Is there, what's the situation as far as the Iraqi people and the Kurdish forces?
It's a very complex situation when it comes to the relationships between the different forces. The Iraqi government, let me explain. The Iraqi government, Baghdad, is run by Abadi, and Abadi he's Shia positions, and he's largely looked at as a proxy for Iranian interests in the area. And because that's true, that's one of the main reasons why ISIS was so successful in the north, because Sunni Muslims in the north, and traditionally it's a Sunni area, didn't want to have an Iranian proxy government having more say in their lives. Because that's true, the Kurds are also Sunni, and so largely Sunni, and so they have a little bit better relationships with the Iraqi government, but with their intended vote for independence on September 25th, there's a potential for some conflict there. The Shia militias who've been invited in to help, that creates another contracted problem with both Shias and Sunnis, and with the fact that they're taking some really harsh methods for dealing with their opponents. Just as bad as Daesh. Yeah.
So we're seeing now that the war to retake these territories from ISIS is if not completed, has reached a certain phase. The different factions that were part of the resistance to ISIS, are they going to be turning on each other, or are they going to keep something together, do you think?
That's really the fear. I think the conversations now are leaning towards Shia militias becoming a problem and Iraqi forces being forced to deal with them. Shia militias have now decided that they do not want to leave Mosul now that it's been liberated, and so that could become a problem if they become more defiant and stronger than they have in the past because of these recent victories. There's a chance that they could be the new sort of, I don't want to say bogeyman, but they could be the new, you know, problem creating conflict in the area. So yeah.
I see. So Kurdistan has a long-standing desire, the Kurdish people, for an independent nation. It's split between three: Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. Do they really hold hope that one day they'll be able to unify?
Yeah, I don't think that I've ever met a Kurdish person who does not have that hope. Syria is also another strong Kurdish community in the northeast, in Rojava, and there are two more other provinces that have large Kurdish communities. But I think there's not a Kurdish person that I know who does not hope for and desire for some independent Kurdistan. I think that that's going to be it's a long way away at the moment. Turkey obviously has a very strong hand in eastern Turkey. The PKK is still considered a terrorist group. The PKK is the military arm of the Kurdish community in Turkey.
I see.
And EP, which is a more moderate party, has been, you know, very effective, but because they had so much relations with the PKK and with the YPG, which is the military arm for the Kurds in Syria, they're seen as becoming less than moderate and sort of siding with this, what's considered by a lot of people as a terrorist organization.
Why are they considered a terrorist organization?
Well, the PKK has claimed responsibility for a lot of terrorist activity within Turkey. Now, clearly they're fighting for their own independence, so I'm not taking a side here, but I think that from a lot of Turks that I've spoken with and a lot of Kurds I've spoken with as well, the PKK is known to be very heavy-handed in their attempt to achieve independence in Turkey.
Right.
So that's why.
Are you traveling amongst these different groups right now? Do you
travel
amongst them?
I've crossed the border into Turkey many times, spent a lot of time with that community there. I've been in all parts of Iraqi Kurdistan. I have yet to be in Syria. Really love to go there soon, in Iran as well. We'll see. I got plans.
Have you seen United States involvement while you've been there with your own eyes?
Absolutely. And I mean, I know people who work in this part of the world who are either supporting or have some sort of relationship with that, with the U.S. involvement here. The U.S. did over 30 airstrikes to liberate Sinjar in November 2015. So ISIS was there for about roughly a year, a little over a year. And so when the Peshmerga came in to liberate, the U.S. is the one who really laid it down heavy before they could even, in fact, they were hardly even opposed by the time the Peshmerga got there because the U.S. had such heavy
airstrikes from the U.S. So mostly, are there boots on the ground, U.S. troops and forces there, soldiers in uniforms and things like that?
They are, but not in this area. You'll see them in Anbar, protecting the highway between Baghdad and Jordan. You might see them in you know, advisory roles in certain areas, but you're not going to see soldiers in the streets.
Right? They mostly rely on air power and send their planes in, and that's been effective. I usually hear that air power is not too effective. In this case, it's been effective.
Consistently. Since August 2014, the U.S. has been here in airstrikes, heavy airstrikes.
Right, I see. And so as the U.S., are they taking, besides being anti-ISIS, are they taking sides with any of the other forces? Are they supporting one over another, or the Iraqi government, I assume?
Well, the U.S. has supported the Kurdish military, YPG, in Syria up until last year, up until last summer, when Biden made a trip over to Turkey and met with Erdogan to sort of repair some of the damage with Turkey. And because of that, he gave them a little bit more freedom. It wasn't ever said out loud, but shortly thereafter, Turkey started, they brought tanks across the border. They started firing missiles against Kurds in Syria to stop them from their own local war against Assad and against other opposition groups there.
What does that mean? I don't understand. So the Turks came in and fought with the Kurds in order to protect Assad.
Basically, so the Syrian Kurds up until that point had been a U.S. ally in the region in the fight against ISIS. Now, this is a group that has very left leanings. They consider themselves anarchists, confederalism, they call it. It's from their leader who's in prison, Erdogan, who's a PKK member in Turkey. So they have a long history of working in leftist guerrilla warfare, and the U.S. was relying on them to fight ISIS in the region. But following deteriorating relationships between U.S. and Turkey, I think the United States, it would seem pretty apparent that the U.S. gave the go-ahead for Turkey to basically apply pressure to Syrian Kurds not to get too strong.
They were moderates, I think they used the term. What do they mean by that, and do such things exist?
Well, I think when we talk about moderates, we're not talking about the YPG, the Kurdish guerrilla forces in Rojava. I think, if anything, we're talking about opposition forces to Assad that have largely been co-opted. There's not really many truly moderate opposition forces that exist any longer in Syria. A lot of them have been co-opted by, you know, extreme elements. I hate to use the term extreme elements, but the fact of the matter is that that's the verbiage that's passed around here. These are groups who are largely aligned with Al-Qaeda and
highly
ISIS.
Religious oriented, and what is their goal? What is the ISIS, and we hear they say to make the caliphate, whatever that means. I mean, what is the, when you're there on the ground, what do you think their goal has really been, and the goal of the, and how does the goals of people who wanted to change the Assad government for the better interact with that?
You know, I think it's really telling that up until, you know, a year ago, there were many Gulf nations who wanted to do business because they thought that ISIS might be successful. They thought that they were actually going to provide the new law in town and were going to actually be able to be successful creating an Islamic caliphate. I think clearly with the liberation of Mosul and ISIS being pushed back, you know, into Syria and Anbar only in Iraq, I think that they're beginning to realize that's not going to happen. I think generally, in Kurdistan, I think people consider ISIS not to be completely done with, but not nearly as much of a threat as they thought they were going to be.
What is the purpose of the U.S. being there then? I mean, ultimately, they could have handled it themselves. What's the advantage of having U.S. air power there and, you know, adding their finger to the scale?
I think that, like with most of the situations in this region, it was largely about the Kurdish oil fields. Oil and gas fields. Around Kirkuk, there's an enormous oil wealth, and around Erbil and outside of the cities. You know, Daesh got, when I was here in 2014, they got within about 20 minutes of the city, and they were literally in the outskirts of town, scared everyone to death here. And I think the U.S. saw that as their cue at Obama. They saw that as their cue that there's no way they could compromise that kind of oil wealth to ISIS, because they were dealing in illegal oil trade, and they just saw it as their opportunity to come in. A lot of pressure.
Now, since this is Trump Watch, and you're a guest, Stephen Taylor, joining us on Trump Watch on WBAI here in New York, have you seen any change? Is there? And I've talked to people like Ben Anderson, who's a vice reporter in Afghanistan, who's amazed that believe it or not, since Trump's been in power, there's been less American interest in these areas. And in fact, it's it's Mad Dog Mattis who's really been pushing the policy. What do you find where you are?
The U.S. has still been instrumental in the liberation of Mosul. So they're clearly still, they're still in the neighborhood. They're still advising. In Syria, I think that it's been ramped up to fight in Raqqa for the U.S. to sort of try to eliminate the centers of operation for ISIS in Syria. As far as Kurds are concerned, I've heard a lot of dismay and fear that their visa issues are gonna multiply. A lot of people trying to they've seen the U.S. as an ally throughout this whole endeavor, and they really want to try to immigrate or try to have a relationship or do business or see their family, and they're having a hard time doing that. And I think there's a lot of fear it could get worse under Trump. There's not a lot of love for Trump in the area. A lot of people, consistently, people I speak with see him as unhinged and unstable.
So it's not the United States. They're focusing on Trump being unhinged and unstable, not really voicing a clear policy one way or the other.
Correct. They still see the U.S. and U.S. citizens as a very positive, relationship and something, people that they want to get to know and they want to work with. But they do not see the Trump administration and Trump himself as like a reliable leader in this.
And less because of ideology, more because of incompetence and craziness.
In behavior, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what people are seeing, right? It just doesn't make sense. Rather than, I talk to people who are going door to door in North Carolina where he won, and they're saying they don't like him because they were shocked that he's an incompetent. They thought he was supposed to be a good businessman from New York. And
that's
shocked.
It. And I think the business side, right?
Yeah.
They're saying, oh, yeah, so he's a good businessman, and that's important. And they're not unused to, an orthodox leadership, obviously, in this part of the world. But I think they just see the way that he behaves as very sort of he can't control himself. And that's,
But has that bled over into the way the U.S. military are advising or conducting their support of the Kurds and others there yet?
If anything, I think it's becoming more targeted, and I think the hand has gotten heavier. I think there was, I believe it was March 17th, there was an airstrike, a U.S. airstrike in Mosul that killed over 100 people, and it was brutal. And I think there was a lot of talk whether it was Iraqi forces, the U.S. forces, but out of that came the real possibility the U.S. had come down really hard in the liberation of Mosul effort.
We see it as sort of typical U.S. heavy-handed imperialistic tactics, but it's seen a little bit differently there.
Yeah, and I think this last round, I think that it was because Trump had come in, and I think not to paint an unclear picture about Obama, but I think towards the end of his administration, he had sort of eased a little bit in terms of the intensity of the attacks. The death count was lower. I think under Trump, I think almost immediately, it was almost as if he had sort of balanced that Russia's position in Aleppo with a similar U.S. response and just come in with a really heavy hand.
I see. And is that continuing, or is that sort of back? Was that just sort of maybe just I'm here, new guys in charge, or is this something that's continuing?
It continued up until the end of the liberation of Mosul. There were reports of very heavy civilian casualties up until the end of the liberation.
And how? What do you expect next from the U.S.?
I think that they're going to focus in on Tal Afar. They're going to focus in on Anbar. There's still a lot of ISIS movement in Anbar, right on the border of Jordan and Syria, where that comes together. I think they're going to focus very heavily on Syria, on Raqqa, and all of the centers of operation for ISIS in Syria. And then I think you're going to have to watch out and kind of see what happens with the independence vote here, because the U.S. is just, don't forget, the U.S. has just signed a huge $500 billion arms deal with Saudi. And I think a lot of people in the region are seeing Saudi Arabia as sort of potentially the new police for the region, letting the U.S., allowing them to be the new police in the region instead of the U.S.
Okay, another minute or two. How about yourself? Have you felt unsafe at all? Have you been in any situation?
Sure. I mean, like I said, I've been in and out of here for about, 4 years now. So I've definitely had, you can't be in the region and not have some run-ins with some pretty, sketchy situations. Nothing recently. My trip into Mosul was actually very interesting. Got to embed a little bit with the civil defense forces, the folks who dig people out, and bring in the heavy equipment to sort of find those who survived attacks. I just got back from Dahok last weekend. I was in a Yazidi camp called the Sharia camp in Sharia town. I'm working with the Yazidi community to sort of help them bring some some unorthodox educational opportunities for the kids there, because the schools are overcrowded, mm-hmm. and they're just having no opportunities to get any education for these kids, and they're all orphans and kids who, like, you know, were part of that death march and were part of this whole attempted massacre, or attempted genocide rather. It's clearly a massacre, and so we're just trying to work with them and see if we can do something for them this summer. So I've been, you know, working on a project called Painting Survival. It's essentially art therapy, but it's an extension of what they're already trying to work on in educational arenas in the area. And I'm just trying to sponsor one of their summer courses so we can, you know, help out with the kids and just give them a nice summer program. And I am working on doing a lot of the contact work, fundraising work. I have identified the NGOs in the area who wanted to partner up and sort of, you know, come together to do this program for the kids. Mm-hmm. And it's something I don't normally do, but let me just tell a personal story. When I was doing some interviews, I did a new documentary called Surviving ISIS for that International Center for Journalists grant. And while I was at it was an abandoned school, and the school was just had probably 20 plus families, 6-7 people to a room plus, mm-hmm. and those kind of, you know, that heat and conditions. And I just remember thinking to myself, there's no way I can take all of their stories and not do something to help them out. So I just started talking to people in the area and said, what do you need? What do you want? And they said, well, we're doing school programs. We're doing pop-up school programs because we don't have, any, mm-hmm. you know, spaces for that right now. So if you could help us out with that, we'd love that. I said, okay. The documentary is now finished. Just going through. I'm just doing a Kickstarter because I wanted to just, you know, put it out and do it my way, I guess. And it's been so far pretty successful.
How can people find out about your Kickstarter?
Sure. If you go on to Kickstarter.com, you can look up Painting Survival - on a Blank Canvas, which refers to the tents and sort of like what they're doing now.
And what's the hope? What's going to happen next with these kids?
The hope is that specifically for this project is that we start raising some spirits, because if we can do a really cool public art project, these kids are about to, and their families are about to go back to Sinjar to start rebuilding. The city's in rubble. It's in, you know, tatters like Aleppo and Mosul and these other cities, and they're really starting to rebuild. So this is sort of, we're hoping this can be sort of a, you know, lift some spirits and get people excited about going in for the reconstruction.
Reconstruction?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is everything right now is the effort of reconstruction.
So they're going to rebuild these cities that have been devastated by years of war now.
Absolutely.
All right. Anything you'd like to add?
If you want to see the trailer for the documentary, it's on YouTube called Surviving ISIS.
Thank you very much, and keep yourself safe, Stephen, all right? We'll stay in touch on this.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.